When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
But once in the air, it could do things that no other aeroplane could do. And I think the point I make in the book, and it's an interesting comparison with Spitfire, is that I don't think that there's any other aeroplane in history that has managed to fulfill successfully all four roles that air power doctrine suggests an Air Force needs to carry out.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bowen. In March 1945, the RAF's 140 wing of 2 Group of the 2nd Tactical Air Force flew an audacious raid into the heart of Copenhagen. They flew at wavetop level all the way across the North Sea and then down into Copenhagen itself, where they attacked the Shell House, which was the headquarters of the Gestapo. Now, 140 Wing had form. They'd done this thing before. But this particular raid is one of interest for us today, as we are joined by Roland White, who's the author of Mosquito, the RAF's legendary wooden wonder and its most extraordinary mission. And it really is an extraordinary story. Throughout the book, we look at what's going on in Denmark, along with the incredible men of 140 Wing, led by the mercurial Basil Embry, who we will talk about, probably not as much as we should, but he's a massive rabbit hole. Roland very generously gave me some of his time, so if you're watching this on day of release, the book is out today, especially here in the UK. Links in the description below to grab it. Do all the likes and subscribes, all that good stuff. But we have to start with the elephant in the room, because if I go over here to the bookshelf and I grab his last book, which is Harrier 809, right at the back, there's a teaser in it for what should have been the next book. So we have to start by asking Roland, why didn't we get the Tornado book? Let's get starting, because the opening question is the one I asked you when we were at Paul's thing, because I have, of course, Harrier 809, which is fantastic. And at the end of it, you have a fantastic tease for 617 Squadron in the Gulf. That didn't happen. So what was the story behind that? I think I know the answer. It's the C word. Why didn't we get the 617 book?
It was a book I was really excited about writing. I talked to my publisher about writing a trilogy of books that took us from, I suppose, the late 70s through to around 2000. And the idea was that Harrier 809 would be the first and would start with Simon Hargreaves intercepting the first Argentinian aircraft that encountered the task force in 1982, would skip through Tornado in the mid-80s, seen largely through the prism of 617 Squadron's involvement in the 1984 for Giant Voice Strategic Air Command bombing competition, which they were not expected to do well in, at least by the Pentagon, but ended up winning. And in doing so, established some of the expertise in medium-level bombing that would then be required in Gulf War One, when a precision bombing capability was introduced, interestingly, by Bob Iverson, as boss of 617 Squadron, who had been shot down flying a Harrier in the Falklands. And then the trilogy was going to finish with a book that looked at Britain's relationship with stealth, ending with the selection of the X-35 over the X-32 in the famous Joint Strike Fighter X-plane competition, through the prism of the RAF pilots who flew the F-117 stealth fighter on exchange, but ending with an epilogue that featured Simon Hargreaves, who you'll remember was going to feature in the prologue of the first book, or did feature in the prologue of the first book, flying the first X mission in which he took off normally, or short takeoff, refueling supersonic flight, and then landed vertically in the same sortie, thus proving the capability of the X-35. And I'd got about two-thirds of the way through all the interviews for the second book, the 617 Squadron book, and then COVID hit. And suddenly all of those road trips that I was planning over the summer to go and do the last few interviews with the people involved in that 1984 bombing competition kind of went up in smoke. And, you know, all of us were wondering, you know, how we would fill the time that we had been given through no longer commuting, how we were going to reorganize our lives as a result of the restrictions that were imposed on us. And I thought, well, I need to try and find a subject to replace the 617 Squadron book, which I can't pursue in the way that I'd wanted to, with something I can. And it struck me that doing a Second World War story, where I would be relying on archives and previously written accounts, given that all of the participants were already deceased, was the way forward. And I'd always loved the Mosquito, and I'd always been aware of those 140 wing raids, Amiens prison, Aarhus in Jutland, and then obviously perhaps the most substantial one of them, the raid on the Gestapo HQ in Copenhagen, and thought, right, let's take a dive into Second World War, which I'd never done before. I'd always sort of almost deliberately steered clear of it because I felt there were people like James Holland and Ben McIntyre and John Nicol doing it really, really well, whereas I'd sort of found my own Cold War niche. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, still want that tornado book. It sounds
good. Yeah. I mean, I do too. I do too. It's trying to establish lost momentum is tough. But that tornado book, and just to tempt you further, because I mean, I really am interested in it. In that story, you also have the Australian F-111s who competed in the same competition. You've also got F-111s from Lakenheath in Norfolk, Suffolk rather, competing in the same competition. I spoke to some of the Australian crews involved. The one of the navigators was the navigator aboard the Canberra that dropped the last Australian bomb in Vietnam. So you've got all sorts of threads that can come into that story. And it's got a lot going for it, without a doubt. And so anyway, I've got to make a decision about what's next. And that is in the frame, but I may have caught the Second World War bug as well.
It bites hard, that one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it, really, because I thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you so much for sending over a copy nice and early, because I devoured it. It was, I have to admit, didn't devour it as quickly as Harrier 809.
I think that's because it's about 40% longer than Harrier 809. I think Harrier 809 is in lots of ways a more obviously, I mean, this is the beauty of the Falklands War. It was 6 weeks long. Mm-hmm. You know, any story about the Falklands War is, you know, it's by definition self-contained, and you can feed different threads into it. Whereas, the story in in Copenhagen, in Mosquito, depends on you understanding the things that came first. And unless you have a, unless you have become engaged with, involved with, and invested in the things that led to that raid, and that is the career of the Mosquito, the people who led the wing that carried out the raid, but also of the lives and the efforts of the people on the ground in Denmark who begged for it. It doesn't carry the sort of substance and resonance that you know, any good story needs. You need to care about everybody involved, and for that you have to go back 2 years. So I'm not talking about 6 weeks. I'm talking about 2 years. So really, the beginning of 1943 is where the story begins.
The thing that I really enjoyed about Mosquito is actually less the Mosquito bits. It was that whole, the whole section, the research you did into the Danish resistance, because Denmark has, in the sort of popular readings of things, you know, we hear about what's going on in Holland and France, mainly because of, you know, Market Garden and Overlord. But Denmark was that sort of strange place, because the, when the Nazis invaded, annexed it in April 1940, they called it a model protectorate, because they were trying to do something different with Denmark. What was that? Because that really creates a lot of tension within the various groups within Denmark.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Hitler and the Nazis really had no designs on Denmark at all. They were probably, you know, happy enough for, would have been happy enough for it to remain neutral, except that in order to seize Norway, which was a country that they really did want to take control of because of, you know, iron ore supplies and the rest of it, they needed Denmark as a stepping stone. So Denmark was really just a casualty of geography. It was on the way to Norway. Denmark had no, the armed forces were, you know, utterly incapable of resisting any kind of Nazi attack. And unlike Norway, there wasn't the space or the geography to get the government and the king away from the country before the Germans were there. They came into Copenhagen, they came up north through Schleswig-Holstein at exactly the same time. And the decision was taken that in order to save lives, they had to go along with the German demand that they would remain, you know, independent under German control, and Germany would protect their neutrality. So they remained for certainly 3 years. Denmark was in this sort of weird superposition between occupation and independence, neutrality, and being part of the Axis, in which they had an elected government and the king remained in Copenhagen. And so they were, from a legal point of view, an Axis power. So unlike, you mentioned the Netherlands and France and others, unlike the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Poland, there was no possibility of free Danes simply joining and setting up units of their own under the Allied command. You know, Denmark had the, it had a unique position, and the Germans hoped that through a light touch they would be able to sort of demonstrate the world that, to the world, that actually, you know, being under the protectorate of the Reich was not necessarily the worst thing in the world. So they had an interest in Denmark being happy, stable, well-fed, comfortable, and all the rest of it.
You start introducing the most fabulous cast of characters in Denmark. We're going to get to the RAF guys, and I'm purposely putting Basil Emery as far back as we could, because that's a rabbit hole we can disappear down for a while. But the thing that I found really interesting is you've got the tensions within Denmark from those who were trying not to cause trouble and those who wanted to resist. You have that tension. Then in London as well, you've got a bit of a turf war between MI6 and SOE as well over Denmark. For you writing it, and you explain it beautifully, how do you sort of unpick all those tensions so that you can make it make sense? Because I can see when you were probably reading the files, you were just sort of pulling your hair out at times.
I mean, it was it was the thing I think which concerned me most. I mean, there is more, undoubtedly, there's more that happens on the ground in this story than in the other books. And I, in the end, was there was a gift in the for me in the shape of a gathering of two families in Denmark in the summer of 1939 that seemed to me to offer a through line which at the same time as introducing them at the beginning carried me through to the end, through which I could explore all sorts of other directions and keep connecting it to the center. And I, you know, it was one of those sort of eureka moments. And occasionally, as you're doing your research, you come across them. And so it was two families, the Lassens and the Wichfelds, got together in the summer of 1939 before war had broken out. But undoubtedly, you know, storm clouds were forming over Europe. They were an the Lassens were Danish. German family, and the Wichfelds were an Anglo-Danish family. On the Wichfeld side, Monica, there's the sort of matriarch, was an Irish aristocrat who, in search, you know, thought Ireland was boring as a teenager growing up, despite having helped work as a gun runner for her father. It was sort of, you know, the rural life in Ireland was too small for her. Married a Danish aristocrat who worked at the embassy and moved to Denmark, where she became the sort of the head of his estate there. Her great friend was Suzanne Lassen, and she was a children's book illustrator. Their kids are interesting too. Monica Wichfeld had three, daughter Inky and two boys. Suzanne Lassen had a couple of boys, and also there that summer was their cousin. Inky Wichfeld went on, she was 19 years old, she went on to marry the head of the SOE in Denmark after becoming his secretary. Monica ran the resistance on an island called Lolland, and went on to become the first Danish woman sentenced to death by the Nazis, and a sort of rallying point for the resistance as a result. Anders Lassen, Suzanne's oldest son, became the only member of the SAS during the Second World War to win the VC, and he's an extraordinary character. His story alone is a podcast. Anders' brother, Franz, also managed to escape from Denmark, and he joined SOE as an agent and was parachuted back into to Copenhagen as an explosives instructor. And then their cousin, Axel van den Busch, was a member of an elite Prussian unit who, disgusted, appalled by witnessing the killing of Jews by the SS in Ukraine, realized he could no longer serve the regime that he should have been loyal to, and made his way to the German resistance and to Klaus von Stauffenberg, and he became the first person tasked with assassinating Hitler. And when we can talk about that later, obviously it didn't happen, but it was a whisker. It was a well-planned, very, very elegantly thought-out operation, which faltered right within days of taking place at the hand of mosquitoes, ironically enough. But through those, through Monica and her daughter Suzanne and her sons, I was able to find a way of linking a lot of that stuff that happened on the ground in Denmark in a way that felt as if it was a really compelling story that belonged together.
I think you succeeded.
Thank you. It was fun. I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, you can imagine as a writer, you kind of get that. You think this is just gold. What, you know, this is just fantastic.
Because We won't spoil it too much, dear listener. But yeah, Fleming's most Ralph Hollingsworth as well, running the show back in London as well. They're just wonderful characters, and you know, you get into things about expenses and stuff, which normally would be a bit dry, but you think they're, yeah, they could they
expenses. Could be... God, this we don't want to sell this book on the strength of expenses, Matt.
I wish you hadn't mentioned that. No, but I thought it was great. You know, here we are. We're all probably about to get shot tomorrow. So yeah, let's use the kitty to the best. Yeah.
You're talking about Fleming Moose, who, as I mentioned, Inky Wichfeld married, and Fleming Moose was quite a character. He was exiled to West Africa he was part of a very wealthy family in Denmark, exiled to West Africa for forging a check on the company account, and then he became a sort of Kurtz type character in West Africa, where he essentially had complete autonomy over a region. Trading region. But when war broke out, as many of the expats did, he kind of felt more strongly about the idea that Germany shouldn't, the idea of Germany's occupation of Denmark should not stand, than many of the people who were in Denmark. And he made his way by dugout canoe, by torpedoed freighter, and ultimately British destroyer, all the way back to Liverpool, where he joined SOE, was trained as a parachute agent, and then parachuted back into Denmark to take control of SOE in January 1943. Up until then, between 1940 and 1943, the Special Operations Executive effort in Denmark, led by Ralph Hollingworth, who was a Royal Navy reserve officer who had been in Denmark on the day of the invasion, had been bedeviled by bad luck. But with Moose, it suddenly kind of caught a wave. He was for all his flaws, he was incredibly energetic. He was a doer. And he made all the sort of necessary connections to accelerate the work of SOE in Denmark and really make sure that those who were inclined to fight the Germans had the equipment and the organization and the support from Britain that they needed to do that.
It's a fantastic cast of individualists, isn't it, who sort of band together? Because when we start looking at the other side, as we said, we're going to get on to Basil and Brie as well, but... we've got the Mosquito itself, which is the most amazing individualist aircraft you could think of. And despite my love for a certain Hawker aircraft, which I'm sure we'll get mentioned in a minute, I think, and I said this on the old History Rage thing, I think it's the Mosquito that should get the adoration the Spitfire does, because people think the Spitfire did everything. The Mosquito literally did. I guess because it's this sort of central character as much as the people that fly them and the Danes as well. To you, what makes the Mozzie so special?
I mean, it's a sort of well-worn cliche, isn't it? That if it looks right, it flies right. You can think of lots of examples of where that's not the case. But if there were an example of an aeroplane that absolutely embodies that notion, it's the Mosquito. I mean, when Geoffrey de Havilland, the man behind the de Havilland aircraft company, first saw it, he said it seems to be made mostly of engines and propellers, and it does have that sort of incredibly sort of aggressive, powerful, front-footed feel to it. Even on the ground, it's all kind of power and potential, and in the air, that was no less true. When it was first demonstrated to Hap Arnold, the U.S. Army general who ran the Army Air Corps in spring of 1941, he saw a number of planes that year. But that was the Mosquito was the airplane that he reckoned was outstanding and insisted on taking a full set of plans back with him. But it's because Geoffrey de Havilland's son, also confusingly called Geoffrey, had performed a display for him, which ended in a sort of spiraling vertical climb above the airfield, which I'm sure was impressive enough. And then repeated the whole display with one engine feathered. So if the first time didn't impress you, the second time really was going to impress you. But every pilot who flew the Mosquito had sort of similar fondness for it. It absolutely tugged to the left on takeoff because it had two propellers that were powerfully spinning in the same direction. But once in the air, it could do things that no other aeroplane could do. And I think the point I make in the book, and it's an interesting comparison with Spitfire, is that I don't think that there's any other aeroplane in history that has managed to fulfill successfully all four roles that air power doctrine suggests an air force needs to carry out. So obviously, fighter air defense is kind of straightforward enough. So the Mosquito was the most effective night fighter of the Second World War and racked up a huge tally of kills in that capacity. It was designed as a fast bomber and it excelled in that. That role could carry to Berlin a bomb load that was as substantial as the early models of the B-17 Flying Fortress. But it did it with a crew of two instead of 10. And it could do it twice in a night because it was so fast rather than once. The third role is intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance. And the Mosquito was the preeminent reconnaissance airplane, Second World War, responsible for crisscrossing Europe and bringing back vitally important photographs like those that told us where the Germans were developing the V1 and V2 missiles. And then lastly, this is perhaps most surprisingly of all, is mobility and air transport. And here, the Mosquito was sort of pressed into service for British Aircraft, British Overseas Airways Corporation, the precursor to British Airways, to fly the ball bearing route, what was known as the ball bearing route between RAF Lucas and Stockholm in Sweden. Stockholm supplied the best ball bearings in the world. They were required for every single aero engine that we made. So every Merlin that went into a Lancaster, Spitfire, Hurricane, Mosquito, Halifax, the rest of it required ball bearings. You had to run the gauntlet of the German air defences in northern Denmark and southern Norway between Scotland and Stockholm to do that. DC-3s were hopelessly vulnerable as a couple that were shot down by DC-3s that were shot down by the Germans demonstrated. But the Mosquito had a chance of getting through. And so 12 Mosquitoes that were on the civil register for BOAC, flown by civilian crews, flew in to and from Denmark. But as well as ball bearings and diplomatic baggage, they also carried passengers. They could carry in a felt line bomb bay with a oxygen mask, sandwich and a flask of coffee, a single passenger. And the remarkable number of people, they brought back pilots and navigators, air crew had been shot down and occupied Europe and made their way to Sweden. But they also brought back, most notably perhaps, Niels Bohr, who was after Einstein, perhaps the most second famous scientist in the world, nuclear physicist, eventually persuaded when the Germans moved against the Jewish population in Denmark to leave. He was flown back from Sweden to Scotland in the belly of a Mosquito in a flight, which, because he had such a large head, nearly killed him. He genuinely couldn't get the oxygen mask to fit. And so he lost consciousness at altitude and sort of dropped out of the bomb bay when they arrived in Scotland. And the crew, who'd been concerned about his silence throughout the flight, thought they might have killed him, but happily he was revived and none the worse for his experience. But there were many, many. I mean, they also used to carry people to Sweden to carry out cultural visits for the British Council. Like, composer and conductor Malcolm Sargent was flown out to Stockholm to do music, and sadly it wasn't in a Mosquito. It was actually in one of the other airplanes, which prior to the Mosquito, BOAC used. T.S. Eliot was flown to Stockholm for the same reason, to conduct a cultural tour. The ambassador wasn't sure what kind of books to leave in T.S. Eliot's room until he discovered that he was a great lover of crime fiction, so he just put crime books in there. But Eliot came back to the embassy after a poetry reading, covered in lipstick kisses, because he'd been sort of mobbed by Swedish fans. I mean, sadly, he didn't go in the belly of a Mosquito, but
that that whole ferry route is just the most.
Yeah.
You look at it now, you think that's nuts. And, you know, I guess if you've never heard of Niels Bohr, but you went to see Oppenheimer, that's the Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, right. He mentions the British put in the Bombay. Of course, you know, in talking about the four roles, I haven't even mentioned that this thing was made out of wood. And that was the thing that annoyed Goering, the head of the Luftwaffe, kind of almost more than anything. He said... When his big day on he was supposed to be making a speech on the 10th anniversary of the Nazis' accession to power, when his big day was ruined by a very, very well-timed mosquito bombing run, 11 a.m. over Berlin, he sort of ranted that he was green and yellow with envy about these machines that the British, who could afford aluminium better than the Germans, could make in any piano factory all around the country. And I mean, on another occasion, said to them, you know, look, forget all your efforts. This was to the head of his, the technical heads of all the German aircraft companies. Forget it. Let us make this amazingly primitive aircraft, he said, you know, dripping with sarcasm. Let's make mosquitoes. We'd be better off just making mosquitoes. Really, really wound him up, because the Berliners would say, you know, well, and this is quoted, this is from Adolf Galland's book, the fighter race charged with trying to protect Germany. He said, the Berliners would say, you know, what is it? You know, the fat one can't even protect us from a few little mosquitoes. And they, you know, they never came up with the Jet 262, a machine that could reliably intercept the mosquitoes.
Yeah. See Colin Bell for more on that.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we're at the Pima Air and Space Museum with our Douglas A-20G Havoc. The A-20 Havoc was an attack aircraft, light bomber of World War II. Originally built and designed with a glass nose with a bombardier. In the Pacific Theater, like B-25s, Pappy Gunn came up with this idea of manning these aircraft with solid noses and a bunch of machine guns for doing strafing attacks on Japanese airfields and attacking Japanese shipping. This aircraft is an actual combat veteran. It flew with the 89th Bomb Squadron in New Guinea on a mission, I think bombing WEWAC. It was damaged and made an emergency landing in a swamp in New Guinea. The crew was recovered and the aircraft sat there pretty much forever until it was found in the 80s, and in the early 90s it was recovered by the Royal Australian Air Force. This A-20 with another one that they had, they restored the one Helen Pelican, which was another combat veteran from the Pacific. They used a lot of the parts from this aircraft for that aircraft. Then actually went to a civilian owner, and then we ended up buying from that civilian owner and finished up the restoration, put it on display here. It's a unique aircraft in the fact there's only about four, if I recall, A-20 Havocs anywhere on display in the world, with one in a private collection, one at the Air Force Museum, one here, and one in a private collection in Russia. But I'd say it's always been one of my favorite aircraft, I think just because of the, you know, lack of them as survivors, and also just seeing a lot of those cool photos from World War II where you see these A-20s coming in low over a ball, bombing Japanese cruisers and transports, and you know they're like literally flying right like at mass height over these ships. So I just always found it to be a pretty cool airplane.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And now, back to the show. Let's talk about those mosquito raids, because I think there's always someone in your books that I just fall in love with, and in this one it was Ted Sizemore, the navigator, because that poor lad had some stress. Mm-hmm. You know, the low level raids that they're having to fly, and he's having to do by dead reckoning at 300 miles an hour at literal wave top levels, and he's what, 22? I think.
I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I've got a son who's the same age as Ted Sizemore, I'm not going to be rude about him now, but I mean, he has just today been given a place on a university air squadron, which is very exciting. But there's a big difference between being given a place on a university air squadron and being responsible for delivering 18 mosquitoes on over 3 hours from Norfolk to downtown Copenhagen to hit a single building. And the pressure that this young man, Ted Sizemore, was under, and like you, Matt, he was almost, before even Basil Embry, Ted Sizemore, this young navigator, was my way into it, because it seemed so unlikely somehow that such a young man could make such an impression on such a senior officer so quickly and be given such extraordinary levels of responsibility. And he was the person I first wanted to try to get to know a little more. And I managed, through an auction house who'd sold his medals, to make contact with his son, who was only too happy to help. Every so often you kind of come across there's something makes your day and puts a huge smile on your face. When I got in touch with Martin Sizemore, his son, he knew me, much to my surprise, because actually both he and Ted, before he died in 2012, had read Vulcan 607. So, the thought that Ted Sizemore, who went on to become, by just 23 at the end of the war, 1945, was just 23 years old, the most decorated navigator of the entire war, had read Vulcan 607. And one of the things which surprised me, and perhaps kind of bound me to his story even more tightly, was the discovery that after leaving the Air Force, he had a very successful career in the Air Force after the Second World War. He worked for Marconi and had, during the Falklands War, been the sort of go-between responsible for ensuring that the RAF could get a mobile radar that was in storage, a Marconi mobile radar that was in storage from the UK to Chile, to give early warning of raids against the British fleet from Argentina. So there's a lovely sort of symmetry about that for me. I'm obviously very sad I didn't get to talk to Ted Sizemore myself, but I managed to find quite a lot of interview footage with him, and also talk to Martin, his son, about some of the things that I hadn't had a chance to read about elsewhere. I mean, a really remarkable man, very sort of mild-mannered, but there was always this sort of real quiet confidence to him, which clearly Basil Embry, who's a sort of legendary RAF figure, identified, recognised, and put absolute trust in. I mean, Embry was, in his mid-40s by now, but he was putting the responsibility for the success of these extremely difficult, challenging raids, in which there were so many moving parts, so many opportunities to get it wrong, in the hands of a navigator who's just 23 years old.
And Embry's one of those guys who talent spot so well, doesn't he? Because he's in charge of two group, which in and of itself, we could be here for hours.
Yeah.
But he's just this remarkable, almost anti-authority sort of figure, isn't he? And I have a question from one of my Patreon people, which feeds into who Basil Embry is. Fantastic. We call them damn Castillos. Well, I do. I don't think they like it, but it's where are we? I've gone and put it up here. Here we go. Errol Cavett was asking, is there any indication that a ride along with senior officers happened? I guess with Basil, we need to talk about Wing Commander Smith, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I mean, you know, Embry was too senior. I mean, it wasn't simply that he was too senior. Embry had been in the Air Force throughout the 30s. Interestingly, Bomber Harris had been his squadron commander when they were stationed in Iraq, and he'd been to Afghanistan. He'd won the DFC before the Second World War even broke out, Embry. And he was a squadron commander. He was a boss of a Blenheim squadron during the Battle of France. And on the day that he was supposed to hand over command to his successor, he realized that he could slip in one last raid just before the deadline, which he did, and got shot down. And of course, you know, Embry being Embry, he was picked up not by just anyone, but by the sort of most senior German tank commander that was there in France. So he wore the sort of, you know, Nazi general's great coat in the car. Was he was interrogated about the flak. He said, well, yeah, I think your flak is very good. It shot me down after all. But that was the beginning of a sort of 2-month odyssey where he escaped from the Germans and was evading them in France for 2 months. He was captured again, but he killed his guards, hid in a dung heap for 3 hours before getting away after they'd come and gone. Got to Paris, tried to pretend he was American to see if the Americans could get him out, managed to blag a bicycle from the Salvation Army, but eventually he got it back over the border and near Perpignan to Spain in the boot of a car driven by somebody from the British Embassy in Spain. So by the time he was back in the UK and wanting to, you know, fight again, he was always wanting to fight, he had a price on his head because the Germans said he'd murdered his guards. I'm not sure he'd have seen it the same way. So he was a valuable commodity to the Germans, was, as he became ever more senior, somebody who should not have been flying submissions over occupied Europe, but he adopted an identity of Wing Commander Smith. He got dog tags. He had the name tapes put in his flight gear, and got rid of all of his badges of rank and replaced them with Wing Commander Smith's, and then flew on kind of all of the most eye-catching and significant raids that 2 Group and 140 Wing particularly flew for the rest of the war. He took over in summer of 1943. But you know, as they began to prepare for D-Day. The only raid he didn't fly on was the Amiens prison raid, and that was because he was specifically told he could not by Trafford Leigh Mallory, who then insisted that they have a meeting at Fighter Command, so that he could make sure Embry was not disobeying that order. And that also meant poor Ted Sismore couldn't go either, because Embry told him that if you can't go, if I can't go, you definitely can't go either. So it meant Percy Pickard, who was perhaps after Guy Gibson, the most famous bomber pilot in the Air Force, then led the raid, despite being quite inexperienced in flying mosquitoes at low level, and lost his life with his navigator on that raid.
The Amiens raid is just remarkable. You know, flying in snow at low level. Yeah, with minimal fighter cover, because most of the Typhoons had turned back, and you've got 174 and 243, I think, were the ones that stuck with them. And of course, the one sector they don't cover is the one where Pickard runs into an FW-190.
That's right. Yeah. terrible. God, you think the Amiens raids amazing? You should hear about the Copenhagen raid.
And there's a book all about it, which is. But this is what I liked about it was you cover Amiens, you cover our house. Yeah, Jean de Saint Longchamp gets a mention in there because it's a Gestapo shot. You don't. I did call this one out in our notes. You don't give old 146 wing and their multiple attacks in Amsterdam or Rotterdam under Johnny Wells in typhoons. But there's that.
I don't.
One thing.
Sorry.
It's another book. There's.
But it's a good opportunity for you mentioned. We might have skipped over it if I hadn't left it out, and it's given you an opportunity to mention it now.
There's so much. My notes go on and on, and we've been chatting for ages now. But there's a bit in it where I think it's come up today or this week on military history Twitter that terrible thing, which is napalm in Europe.
Yeah,
and that is something that has always been. Not really discussed. You know, Lee Miller famously had a lot of her footage from St. Malo taken. The Typhoons used it in against positions in Arnhem just before Plunder Varsity. But Embry's men use it to devastating effect in Normandy, don't they? In the summer of 40.
Well, actually, it's a little further south than that. It's an SS barracks. I'm going to forget the. It says Bonne Mature, and I'm going to forget the name of the nearest town to that, but it's a little further south than Normandy. And it's where there was prior to and after D-Day, an SAS unit operating, an operation called Operation Bullbasket. And their job was in harness with the resistance to try to do everything that they could to obstruct and delay and make more difficult the Germans' reinforcement of Normandy. And they were very successful in doing that. The SAS with the resistance actually made sure that the SS didn't get to Normandy at a time when they might have done some damage, and but they were subsequently ambushed in a forest. This SS unit, and they were killed pretty unpleasant. Those who didn't get away were killed pretty nastily. And when word got back, it was requested of two group that they exact vengeance for that. And Basil Embry was only too happy to do that. And they were using. For the first time, for the British at any rate, napalm, which had been developed in the States. It's nasty stuff. It's designed to burn a great temperature, but also to sort of glom onto whatever it's stuck to. And, you know, the Embry's sort of parting statement in the briefing prior to the mission, when he'd explained who their target was and what they had done to these SAS men that they'd captured and who should have been, were it not for the Hitler's commando order, treated as prisoners of war and with all of the protections that affords. He explained all of that and said to his crews, you know, you let the bastards burn. And that's exactly what happened. The mosquitoes went in, took out a line of barracks on next to a river, and there wasn't much left of either them or the SS who had been in there tucking into lamb stew made with animals that they had poached from local farmers.
It was a perfect target. It was wood barracks in a wood, which is exactly what napalm was designed to go after.
I mean, Embry yielded to no one in his hatred of the enemy. I mean, that what he had seen in France at the beginning of the war, there, you know, he'd seen them running over refugees in tanks. He was very kind of affected by that and driven by it, and a determination to not rest actually until the Germans were beaten. And he sought other people who he identified that trait in too.
because they're going to have to be pushing home against targets that most people would balk at. On that thought of pushing on, another one of my Patreon listeners, who's we probably all know, it's Joe Wilding, friend of the show, who's been on. He was asking when you were reading it, and you do point this out in the book, what you sort of found when a fully loaded Mosquito was going into a target like Copenhagen versus after it had dropped its payload. What sort of speed maneuverability would they notice for it? And you do describe that quite well, especially on the exit on Copenhagen, which, dear listener, you'll notice I'm talking around because you've got to read the book to find out what happens on Operation Carthage. But just on that sort of technical thing, was she a sort of leaden duck before she dropped her load, or was it only afterwards she became the swan?
That's a great sentence. Was she a leaden duck before she dropped her load? No. I mean, you know, the Mosquito was blessed with an abundance of power. And so, you know, takeoffs could be hairy, particularly when they were heavily loaded. And they always had that if you were going to get sort of bitten by a Mosquito, it was going to be on takeoff much more so than landing, even where you've not got power going through the engines. But no, once you're in the air, they were not, because of that abundance of power, overly burdened by a 2,000 pound bomb load. The FB6s that were flown in by two group. They carried two 500 pound bombs in the bomb bay. And this is unlike the bomber models, which carried four, because the breaches from the 20 millimeter cannons in the nose filled up half of the bomb bay. So they had two bombs in the bomb bay, two 500 pound bombs under the wings. And, you know, obviously they're going to be a little bit more nimble than they would have been without a 2,000 pound bomb load. But really the only drag you're creating is minimal and under the wings, because they kept two of them in the bomb bay. I didn't encounter a single reference in the research I was doing to Mosquitoes being kind of heavy, sluggish, difficult to control, unmaneuverable, anything else suggesting that they were kind of anything less than they might have been when they were carrying bombs. I mean, you know, you only sort of hear praise for their performance.
Dear listener, we've run out of time to talk about the shell house and things like that. So there's a fantastic book that is out today when you're listening to this, which will tell you all about it and the incredible people who were unfortunate enough to find themselves in it on that March morning. I have to ask you to wrap up, Roland. Mm-hmm. All of your books are very human. You tend to find that sort of that human thread, as we talked about to come for. This one, with the story of the Danish resistance and the way, not doing a spoiler here because it's the reason there's a raid, they get rolled up quite aggressively towards the end of 44, early 45. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me to be quite a different angle to the sort of the humans, the people that you've written about in the past. How did that affect you as you were writing it?
Quite substantially. You're right to identify it. I felt an enormous duty with this book in a way almost that I haven't with the previous one. If you think about the previous books, with the exception, I mean, you know, that somebody was killed on the Vulcan 607 raid. Obviously, people were killed in Harrier 809, but I'm largely talking about a military fighting a military. And in some cases, in one case, it was a show of force or it's a space mission. But that's quite significantly different to a book about a raid that ultimately takes place in the center of a capital city. And, you know, Embry and Sismore, their first reaction to being begged to carry out this raid by the Danish resistance was that, you know, we're going to kill 300 people. You know, this is, we can't risk this. But the Danes said, you know, unless you do, great many more people are going to be killed because of the resistance is gone. Denmark now until the end of the war, but also Denmark's future after the war is destroyed. I mean, they didn't embrace the prospect of flying the raid with any enthusiasm at all. But, you know, those are the hard choices that people like Embry and Sismore, and indeed the Danes in Copenhagen, who, after weighing up the pros and cons, said, fly the raid, had to contend with. You know, these were really, really difficult decisions to which there was no right answer. But when it comes to the sort of human story, the thing that made the greatest impression on me was getting to meet a man called John Holstein in Denmark. And John's now in his 80s. He was 5 years old in 1944, and he was on the receiving end of bombs from Operation Carthage. He was dug out of rubble. He was taken to a hotel. He was patched up. He had suffered from a fear of flying after that, which he subsequently overcame, well, quite substantially, in that he went on to enjoy a career as a sport parachutist, glider pilot, and with an engineering company that made harnesses for search and rescue helicopters. So he really understood the nature of the thing that these incredible air crews were required to do. But as I said, you know, as a boy, he was traumatized by what had happened in Copenhagen. But I went to visit some of the sites that were relevant to the Copenhagen raid with John, who's sort of incredibly sprightly in his 80s and just a really lovely guy. And we looked up and down the road where actually one of the mosquitoes, I know you've been trying not to sort of share spoilers, but a mosquito was lost on the Copenhagen raid, and there were tragic consequences of that. I went to visit the site with John after we'd gone to some of the other places that were relevant to the raid, including the railway yard where the mosquito that crashed hit a pylon, which led to its crash. And he looked up and down the road and sort of reflected on what it was these air crews had undertaken on behalf of his country and the sacrifice that he'd made, they had made. And he just kind of said quietly to himself that they were heroes. That was, more than anything else, that was the thing that guided and informed how strongly I felt about trying to get this story right. I think almost more than any of the other ones, I felt a real obligation to those who had died in the air, those who had died on the ground, not just in 1944, but, you know, throughout the war, to get their story right. And, you know, I'd be for readers to judge whether or not I have.
To this reader, you did. I thought it was a very difficult thing to balance, and I think you did it very well, especially for what happens on the raid, which is tragic. But as you said, that there's so many balls in the air for it. Dear listener, read the book. It is out today if you're listening to this on the day of release. Give it a plug, Roland. What's it called? It's a very complicated title.
It's called Mosquito. The RAF's legendary wooden wonder and its most extraordinary raid. And at the heart of the book is this unbelievably challenging but crucial raid on the Gestapo headquarters in Denmark. But through the story, through the book, I've kind of threaded, I hope, an appreciation of the mosquito story more broadly.
Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure, Matt. Thanks so much for asking me along.
I cannot thank Roland enough for his time. He was incredibly generous to spend the evening with me the other week. And as we said, today is release day for Mosquito. So this is not the one you would get today. It'll be a lovely hardback like that. So please do look it up. As always, you can get it if you're in the UK from the damcastersbookshop.org. Link in the description below. 10% of that goes to support the pod. We hope to have more from Roland. We'll have to see if he'll come back. But there's lots to talk about. He is fantastic, as you've seen and heard. So thank you so much to him. buy the book. It really is good, because if it wasn't, I wouldn't have had him on the show. Next week, we do have the episode that I teased last week, which is all about R101. And that is the fabulous Sam Gwynne joining us to discuss His Majesty's Airship, which is all about the... This is going to upset a few people. The disastrous R101. Now, people have been tweeting at me because I'm not a fan of the big airship. Let's find out more next week and we can discuss it then. Until then, thank you so much for your support. As always, if you want to join us on Patreon, become a Damcasteer. There's all kinds of stuff happening over there. You get these episodes early with different intros and outros. Opportunities to ask questions like Joe and Errol did in today's episode. So you can join up from £3 a month, plus a bit of VAT. Check the link in the description and you can find out all the details there. Tell your friends as well. Pod's doing well. We got some exciting news coming up about our sponsor, the fabulous Pima Air and Space Museum out in Tucson, Arizona. They've got a lot going on. We're going to talk about that some more. Watch this space and follow us on all the socials, including Blue Sky now, which I'm liking because it's quiet and not nuts. There we go. Until next time, thank you so much for your support. Please do take care of yourselves. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Bony Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.